I'll point pen forward. The point of the Levy Pan's pen did not catch on the first snap and slipped back into the plastic cylinder. Ignatius snapped more vigorously, but again the point slid disobediently back out of sight. Cracking the pen furiously on the edge of his desk, Ignatius picked up one of the Venus Medalist's pencils lying on the floor. He probed the wax in his ears with the pencil and began to concentrate, listening to the sounds of his mother's preparations for an evening at the bowling alley. There were many staccato footfalls back and forth in the bathroom, which meant, he knew, that his mother was attempting to accomplish several phases of her toilet at once. Then there were the noises that he had grown accustomed to over the years whenever his mother was preparing to leave the house. The plop of a hairbrush falling into the toilet bowl, the sound of a box of powder hitting the floor, the sudden exclamations of confusion and chaos.
"Ouch!"
his mother cried at one point. Ignatius found the subdued and solitary din in the bathroom annoying, and wished that she would finish. At last he heard the light click off. She knocked at his door.
"Ignatius, honey, I'm going."
"All right,"
Ignatius replied icily.
"Open the door, babe, and come kiss me goodbye."
"Mother, I am quite busy at the moment."
"Don't be like that, Ignatius. Open up."
"Run off with your friends, please."
"Oh, Ignatius."
"Must you distract me at every level? I am working on something with wonderful movie possibilities. Highly commercial."
Mrs. Riley kicked at the door with her bowling shoes.
"Are you ruining that pair of absurd shoes that were bought with my hard-earned wages?"
"Huh? What's that, precious?"
Ignatius extracted the pencil from his ear and opened the door. His mother's maroon hair was fluffed high over her forehead. Her cheekbones were red with rouge that had been spread nervously up to the eyeballs. One wild paw full of powder had whitened Mrs. Riley's face, the front of her dress, and a few loose maroon wisps.
"Oh, my God!" Ignatius said. "You have powder all over your dress. Although that is probably one of Mrs. Battaglia's beauty hints."
"Why are you always knocking Santa, Ignatius?"
"She appears to have been knocked a bit in her life already. Up rather than down. If she ever nears me, however, the direction will be reversed."
"Ignatius!"
"She also brings to mind the vulgarism, knockers."
"Santa's a grandma. You ought to be ashamed."
"Thank goodness Miss Annie's coarse cries restored peace the other night. Never in my life have I seen so shameless an orgy. And right in my very own kitchen. If that man were any sort of law enforcement officer, he would have arrested that aunt right there on the spot."
"Don't knock Angelo, neither. He's got him a hard road, boy. Santa says he's been in the bathroom at the bus station all day."
"Oh, my God! Do I believe what I'm hearing? Please run along with your two cohorts from the Mafia and let me alone."
"Don't treat your poor mama like that."
"Poor? Did I hear poor? When the dollars are literally flowing into this home from my labors, and flowing out even more rapidly."
"Don't start that again, Ignatius. I only got $20 out of you this week, and I almost had to get down on my knees and beg for it. Look at all them thingamajigs you've been buying. Look at that movie camera you brung home today."
"The movie camera will shortly be put to use. That harmonica was rather cheap."
"We never gonna pay off that man at this rate."
"That is hardly my problem. I don't drive."
"No, you don't care. You never cared for nothing, boy."
"I should have known that every time I open the door of my room, I am literally opening a Pandora's box. Doesn't Mrs. Battaglia want you to await her debauched nephew and her at the curb, so that not one invaluable moment of bowling time will be lost?"
Ignatius belched the gas of a dozen brownies trapped by his valve.
"Grant me a little peace. Isn't it enough that I'm harried all day long at work? I thought that I had adequately described to you the horrors which I must face daily."
"You know I appreciate you, babe,"
Mrs. Riley sniffed.
"Come on and give me a little goodbye kiss like a good boy."
Ignatius bent down and lightly bussed her on the cheek.
"Oh, my God,"
he said, spitting out powder.
"Now my mouth will feel gritty all night."
I got too much powder on?
No, it's just fine. Aren't you an arthritic or something? How in the world can you bowl?
I think the exercise is helping me out. I'm feeling better.
A horn honked out on the street.
Apparently, your friend has escaped the bathroom, Ignatius snorted. It's just like him to hang around a bus station. He probably likes to watch those scenic cruiser horrors arrive and depart. In his worldview, the bus is apparently a good thing. That shows how retarded he is.
I'll be in early, honey,
Mrs. Riley said, closing the miniature front door.
I shall probably be misused by some intruder, Ignatius screamed.
Bolting the door to his room, he grabbed an empty ink bottle and opened his shutters. He stuck his head out of the window and looked down the alley to where the little white rambler was visible in the darkness at the curb. With all of his strength, he heaved the bottle and heard it hit the roof of the car with greater sound effects than he had expected it to.
Hey!
He heard Santa Vitalia shout as he silently closed the shutters. Gloating, he opened his loose-leaf folder again and picked up his Venus Medalist.
Dear reader, a great writer is the friend and benefactor of his readers. Macaulay. Another working day is ended, gentle reader. As I told you before, I have succeeded in laying a patina, as it were, over the turbulence and mania of our office. All non-essential activities in the office are slowly being curtailed. At the moment, I am busily decorating our throbbing hive of white-collared bees. 3. The analogy of the 3 bees brings to mind 3 bees which describe most aptly my actions as an office worker. Banish, benefit, beautify. There are also 3 bees which describe most aptly the actions of our buffoon of an office manager. Bait, beg, blight, blunder, bore, boss, bother, bungle, burden, buzz. In this case, I am afraid the list gets somewhat out of hand. I have come to the conclusion that our office manager serves no purpose other than one of obfuscation and hindrance. Were it not for him, the other clerical worker, La Dama del Comercio, and I would be quite peaceful and content, attending to our duties in an atmosphere of mutual consideration. I am certain that his dictatorial methods are, in part, responsible for Miss T's desire to retire. I can at last describe to you our factory. This afternoon, being fulfilled after having completed the cross, yes, it is completed and gives our office a needed spiritual dimension, I set out to visit the clank and whir and hiss of the factory. The scene which met my eyes was at once compelling and repelling. The original sweatshop has been preserved for posterity at Levy Pants. If only the Smithsonian Institution, that grab bag of our nation's refuse, could somehow vacuum seal the Levy Pants factory and transport it to the capital of the United States of America, each worker frozen in an attitude of labor, the visitors to that questionable museum would defecate into their garish tourist outfits. It is a scene which combines the worst of Uncle Tom's Cabin and Fritz Lang's Metropolis. It is mechanized Negro slavery. It represents the progress which the Negro has made from picking cotton to tailoring it. Were they in the picking stage of their evolution, they would at least be in the healthful outdoors singing and eating watermelons, as they are, I believe, supposed to do when in groups al fresco. My intense and deeply felt convictions concerning social injustice were aroused. My valve threw in a hearty response. In connection with the watermelons, I must say, lest some professional civil rights organization be offended, that I have never been an observer of American folk customs. I may be wrong. I would imagine that today people grasp for the cotton with one hand, while the other hand presses a transistor radio to the sides of their heads so that it can spew bulletins about used cars and soft-style hair relaxer and royal crown hair dressing and Gallo wine about their eardrums, a filtered menthol cigarette dangling from their lips and threatening to set the entire cotton field ablaze. Although residing along the Mississippi River, this river is famed in atrocious song and verse, the most prevalent motif is one which attempts to make of the river an ersatz father figure. Actually, the Mississippi River is a treacherous and sinister body of water whose eddies and currents yearly claim many lives. I have never known anyone who would even venture to stick his toe in its polluted brown waters, which seethe with sewage, industrial waste, and deadly insecticides. Even the fish are dying. Therefore, the Mississippi as Father God, Moses, Daddy, Phallus, Pops, is an altogether false motif, begun, I would imagine, by that dreary fraud Mark Twain. This failure to make contact with reality is, however, characteristic of almost all of America's art. Any connection between American art and American nature is purely coincidental, but this is only because the nation as a whole has no contact with reality. That is only one of the reasons why I have always been forced to exist on the fringes of its society, consigned to the limbo reserved for those who do know reality when they see it. I have never seen cotton growing and have no desire to do so. The only excursion in my life outside of New Orleans took me through the vortex to the whirlpool of despair, Baton Rouge. In some future installment, a flashback, I shall perhaps recount that pilgrimage through the swamps, a journey into the desert from which I returned broken physically, mentally, and spiritually. New Orleans is, on the other hand, a comfortable metropolis which has a certain apathy and stagnation which I find inoffensive. At least its climate is mild. Two, it is here in the Crescent City that I am assured of having a roof over my head and a Dr. Nut in my stomach, although certain sections of North Africa, Tangier, etc., have from time to time excited my interest. The voyage by boat, however, would probably enervate me, and I am certainly not perverse enough to attempt air travel, even if I were able to afford it. The Greyhound bus line is sufficiently menacing to make me accept my status quo. I wish that those scenic cruises would be discontinued. It would seem to me that their height violates some interstate highway statute regarding clearance in tunnels and so forth. Perhaps one of you, dear readers, with a legal turn of mind, can dredge the appropriate clause from memory. Those things really must be removed. Simply knowing that they are hurtling somewhere on this dark night makes me most apprehensive. The factory is a large barn-like structure that houses bolts of fabric, cutting tables, massive sewing machines, and furnaces that provide the steam for pressing. The total effect is rather surreal, especially when one sees Les Africains moving about, attending to their tasks in this mechanized setting. The irony involved caught my fancy, I must admit. Something from Joseph Conrad sprang to my mind, although I cannot seem to remember what it was at the time. Perhaps I likened myself to Kurtz in The Heart of Darkness, when, far from the trading company offices in Europe, he was faced with the ultimate horror. I do remember imagining myself in a pith helmet and white linen jodhpurs, my face enigmatic behind a veil of mosquito netting. The furnaces keep the place rather warm and toasty on these chill days, but in the summer I suspect that the workers once again enjoy the climate of their forebears, the tropic heat somewhat magnified by those great coal-burning steam-producing contrivances. I understand that the factory is not working at capacity currently, and I did observe that only one of these devices was operating, burning coal and what looked like one of the cutting tables. Also, I saw only one pair of trousers actually completed during the time that I spent there, although the factory workers were shambling about, clutching all sorts of scraps of cloth. One woman, I noticed, was pressing some baby's clothing, and another seemed to be making remarkable progress with the sections of fuchsia satin which she was joining together on one of the large sewing machines. She appeared to be fashioning a rather colorful but nonetheless rakish evening gown. I must say that I admired the efficiency with which she whipped the material back and forth under the massive electric needle. This woman was apparently a skilled worker, and I thought it doubly unfortunate that she was not lending her talents to the creation of a pair of Levi pants. There was obviously a morale problem in the factory. I looked for Mr. Palermo, the foreman of the factory, who is, incidentally, normally only a few steps from the bottle, as the many contusions that he has sustained from falling down among the cutting tables and sewing machines can testify, with no success. He was probably quaffing a liquid lunch in one of the many taverns in the vicinity of our organization. There is a bar on every corner in the neighborhood of Levy Pants, an indication that salaries in the area are abysmally low. On particularly desperate blocks, there are three or four bars at every intersection. In my innocence, I suspected that the obscene jazz issuing forth from the loudspeakers on the walls of the factory was at the root of the apathy which I was witnessing among the workers. The psyche can be bombarded only so much by these rhythms before it begins to crumble and atrophy. Therefore, I found and turned off the switch which controlled the music. This action on my part led to a rather loud and defiantly boorish roar of protest from the collective workers, who began to regard me with sullen eyes. So I turned the music on again, smiling broadly and waving amiably, in an attempt to acknowledge my poor judgment and to win the workers' confidence. Their huge white eyes were already labeling me a Mr. Charlie. I would have to struggle to show them my almost psychotic dedication to helping them. Obviously, continual response to the music had developed within them an almost Pavlovian response to the noise, a response which they believed was pleasure. Having spent countless hours of my life watching those blighted children on television dancing to this sort of music, I knew the physical spasm which it was supposed to elicit, and I attempted my own conservative version of the same on the spot to further pacify the workers. I must admit that my body moved with surprising agility. I am not without an innate sense of rhythm. My ancestors must have been rather outstanding at jigging on the heath. Ignoring the eyes of the workers, I shuffled about beneath one of the loudspeakers, twisting and shouting, mumbling insanely, "Go! Go! Do it, baby! Do it! Hear me talking to ya! Wow!" I knew that I had recovered my ground with them when several began pointing to me and laughing. I laughed back to demonstrate that I, too, shared their high spirits. De casibus vivorum illustrium. Of the fall of great men. My downfall occurred. Literally. My considerable system, weakened by the gyrations, especially in the region of the knees, at last rebelled, and I plummeted to the floor in a senseless attempt at one of the more egregiously perverse steps which I had witnessed on the television so many times. The workers seemed rather concerned and helped me up most politely, smiling in the friendliest fashion. I realized then that I had no more to fear concerning my faux pas in turning off their music. In spite of all to which they have been subjected, Negroes are nonetheless a rather pleasant folk for the most part. I really have had little to do with them, for I mingle with my peers or no one, and since I have no peers, I mingle with no one. Upon speaking with several of the workers, all of whom seemed eager to speak with me, I discovered that they received even less pay than Miss Trixie. In a sense, I have always felt something of a kinship with the colored race, because its position is the same as mine. We both exist outside the inner realm of American society. Of course, my exile is voluntary. However, it is apparent that many of the Negroes wish to become active members of the American middle class. I cannot imagine why. I must admit that this desire on their part leads me to question their value judgments. However, if they wish to join the bourgeoisie, it is really none of my business. They may seal their own doom. Personally, I would agitate quite adamantly if I suspected that anyone were attempting to help me upward toward the middle class. I would agitate against the bemused person who was attempting to help me upward, that is. The agitation would take the form of many protest marches complete with the traditional banners and posters, but these would say, "And the middle class. The middle class must go." I am not above tossing a small Molotov cocktail or two, either. In addition, I would studiously avoid sitting near the middle class in lunch counters and on public transportation, maintaining the intrinsic honesty and grandeur of my being. If a middle-class white were suicidal enough to sit next to me, I imagine that I would beat him soundly about the head and shoulders with one great hand, toss in quite deftly one of my Molotov cocktails into a passing bus jammed with middle-class whites with the other hand. Whether my siege were to last a month or a year, I am certain that ultimately everyone would let me alone after the total carnage and destruction of property had been evaluated. I do admire the terror which Negroes are able to inspire in the hearts of some members of the white proletariat, and only wish—this is a rather personal confession—that I possessed the ability to similarly terrorize. The Negro terrorizes simply by being himself. I, however, must browbeat a bit in order to achieve the same end.
Perhaps I should have been a Negro. I suspect that I would have been a rather large and terrifying one, continually pressing my ample thigh against the withered thighs of old white ladies in public conveyances a great deal, and eliciting more than one shriek of panic. Then, too, if I were a Negro, I would not be pressured by my mother to find a good job, for no good jobs would be available. My mother herself, a worn old negress, would be too broken by years of underpaid labor as a domestic to go out bowling at night. She and I could live most pleasantly in some moldy shack in the slums in a state of ambitionless peace, realizing contentedly that we were unwanted, that striving was meaningless. However, I do not wish to witness the awful spectacle of the Negroes moving upward into a middle class. I consider this movement a great insult to their integrity as a people. But I'm beginning to sound like the Beards and Parringtons, and will soon totally forget Levy Pants, the commercial muse for this particular effort. A project for the future could be a social history of the United States from my vantage point. If the Journal of a Working Boy meets with any success at the bookstalls, I shall perhaps etch a likeness of our nation with my pen. Our nation demands the scrutiny of a completely disengaged observer like your working boy, and I already have in my files a rather formidable collection of notes and jottings that evaluate and lend a perspective to the contemporary scene. We must hasten back on the wings of prose to the factory and its folk, who prompted my rather lengthy digression. As I was telling you, they had just lifted me from the floor, my performance and subsequent pratfall the sources of a great feeling of camaraderie. I thanked them cordially, they meanwhile inquiring in their 17th-century English accents about my condition most solicitously. I was uninjured, and since pride is a deadly sin which I feel I generally eschew, absolutely nothing was hurt. I then questioned them about the factory, for this was the purpose behind my visit. They were rather eager to speak with me, and seemed even most interested in me as a person. Apparently, the dull hours among the cutting tables make a visitor doubly welcome. We chatted freely, although the workers were generally non-committal about their work. Actually, they seemed more interested in me than in anything else. I was not bothered by their attentions, and parried all of their questions blithely, until they at last grew rather personal. Some of them, who had from time to time straggled into the office, asked pointed questions about the cross and the attendant decorations. One intense lady asked permission, which of course was granted, to gather some of her confreres about the cross occasionally to sing spirituals. I abhor spirituals and those deadly 19th-century Calvinist hymns, but I was willing to suffer having my eardrums assaulted if a chorus or two would make these workers happy. When I questioned them about wages, I discovered that their average weekly pay envelope contained less than $30. It is my considered opinion that someone deserves more than that in the way of a wage for simply staying in a place like the factory for 5 days a week, especially when the factory is one like the Levy Pants factory, in which the leaking roof threatens to collapse at any moment. And who knows, those people might have much better things to do than to loiter about Levy Pants, such as composing jazz, or creating new dances, or doing whatever those things are that they do with such facility. No wonder there was such apathy in the factory. Still, it was incredible that the disparity between the doldrums of the production line and the fevered hustle of the office could be housed within the same, Levy Pants, bosom. Were I one of the factory workers, and I would probably be a large and particularly terrifying one, as I said earlier, I would long before have stormed the office and demanded a decent wage. Here I must make a note. While I was desultorily attending graduate school, I met in the coffee shop one day a Miss Myrna Minkoff, a young undergraduate, a loud, offensive maiden from the Bronx. This expert from the universe of the Grand Concourse was attracted to the table at which I was holding court by the singularity and magnetism of my being. As the magnificence and originality of my world view became explicit through conversation, the Minkoff minks began attacking me on all levels, even kicking me under the table rather vigorously at one point. I both fascinated and confused her. In short, I was too much for her. The parochialism of the ghettos of Gotham had not prepared her for the uniqueness of your working boy. Myrna, you see, believed that all humans live in south and west of the Hudson River were illiterate cowboys, or, even worse, white Protestants, a class of humans who, as a group, specialized in ignorance, cruelty, and torture. I don't wish to especially defend white Protestants. I'm not too fond of them myself. Soon Myrna's brutal social manner had driven my courtiers from the table, and we were left alone, all cold coffee and hot words. When I failed to agree with her braying and babbling, she told me that I was obviously anti-Semitic. Her logic was a combination of half-truths and clichés, her worldview a compound of misconceptions deriving from a history of our nation as written from the perspective of a subway tunnel. She dug into her large black valise and assaulted me, almost literally, with greasy copies of Men and Masses and Now and Broken Barricades and Surge and Revulsion and various manifestos and pamphlets pertaining to organizations of which she was a most active member. Students for Liberty, Youth for Sex, the Black Muslims, Friends of Latvia, Children for Miscegenation, the White Citizens' Councils. Myrna was, you see, terribly engaged in her society. I, on the other hand, older and wiser, was terribly disengaged. She had chiseled quite a bit of money from her father to go away to college to see what it was like out there. Unfortunately, she found me. The trauma of our first meeting fed each other's masochism and led to an affair, platonic, of sorts. Myrna was decidedly masochistic. She was only happy when a police dog was sinking its fangs into her black leotards or when she was being dragged feet first down stone steps from a Senate hearing. I must admit that I always suspected Myrna of being interested in me sensually. My stringent attitude toward sex intrigued her. In a sense, I became another project of sorts. I did, however, succeed in thwarting her every attempt to assail the castle of my body and mind. Since Myrna and I confused most of the other students when we were apart, as a couple we were doubly confusing to the smiling southern bird brains, who, for the most part, made up the student body. Campus rumor, I understand, linked us in the most unspeakably depraved intrigues. Myrna's cure-all for everything from fallen arches to depression was sex. She promulgated this philosophy with disastrous effects to two southern belles, whom she took under her wing in order to renovate their backward minds. Heeding Myrna's counsel with the eager assistance of various young men, one of the simple lovelies suffered a nervous breakdown. The other attempted unsuccessfully to slash her wrist with a broken Coca-Cola bottle. Myrna's explanation was that the girls had been too reactionary to begin with, and with renewed vigor she preached sex in every classroom and pizza parlor, almost getting herself raped by a janitor in the social studies building. Meanwhile, I tried to guide her toward the path of truth. After several semesters, Myrna disappeared from the college, saying in her offensive manner, "This place can't teach me anything I don't know." The black leotards, the matted mane of hair, the monstrous valise were all gone. The palm-lined campus returned to its traditional lethargy and necking. I have seen that liberated doxy a few times since then, for from time to time she embarks on an inspection tour of the South, stopping eventually in New Orleans to harangue me and to attempt to seduce me with a grim prison and chain gang songs she strums on her guitar. Myrna is very sincere. Unfortunately, she is also offensive. When I saw her after her last inspection tour, she was rather bedraggled. She had stopped throughout the rural South to teach Negroes folk songs she had learned at the Library of Congress. The Negroes, it seems, preferred more contemporary music and turned up their transistor radios loudly and defiantly whenever Myrna began one of her lugubrious dirges. Although the Negroes had tried to ignore her, the whites had shown great interest in her. Bands of crackers and rednecks had chased her from villages, slashed her tires, whipped her a bit about the arms. She had been hunted by bloodhounds, shocked by cattle prods, chewed by police dogs, peppered lightly with shotgun pellets. She had loved every minute of it, showing me quite proudly and, I might add, suggestively, a fang mark on her upper thigh. My stunned and disbelieving eyes noted that on occasion she was wearing dark stockings and not leotards. My blood, however, failed to rise. We do correspond quite regularly, the usual theme of Myrna's correspondence tending to urge me to participate in lie-ins and weigh-ins and sit-ins and such. Since, however, I do not eat at lunch counters and do not swim, I have ignored her advice. The subsidiary theme in the correspondence is one urging me to come to Manhattan so that she and I may raise our banner of twin confusion in that center of mechanized horrors. If I'm ever really well, I may make the trip. At the moment, that little musky Minkoff minx is probably in some tunnel far beneath the streets of the Bronx, speeding in a subway train from a meeting on social protest to an orgy of folk singing, or worse. Someday the authorities of our society will no doubt apprehend her for simply being herself. Incarceration will finally make her life meaningful and end her frustration. A recent communication from her was bolder and more offensive than usual. She must be dealt with on her own level, and thus I thought of her as I surveyed the substandard conditions in the factory. Too long have I confined myself in Miltonic isolation and meditation. It is clearly time for me to step boldly into our society, not in the boring, passive manner of the Mene Minkoff school of social action, but with great style and zest. You will be witnesses to a certain courageous, daring, and aggressive decision on the part of the author, a decision which reveals a militancy, depth, and strength quite unexpected in so gentle a nature. Tomorrow I will describe in detail my answer to the Myrna Minkoffs of the world. The result may, incidentally, topple, all too literally, Mr. Gonzalez as a power within Levy Pants. That fiend must be dealt with. One of the more powerful civil rights organizations will no doubt cover me with laurels. There is an almost unbearable pain needling my fingers as a result of these overabundant scribblings. I must lay down my pencil, my engine of truth, and bathe my crippled hands in some warm water. My intense devotion to the cause of justice has led to this lengthy diatribe, and I feel that my lever circle within a circle is zooming upward to new successes and heights. Health note. Hands crippled. Valve temporarily open. Halfway. Social note. Nothing today. Mother gone again, looking like a courtesan. One of her cohorts, you might like to know, has revealed his hopelessness by revealing a fetish for greyhound buses. I'm going to pray to Saint Martin de Porres, the patron saint of mulattoes, for our cause in the factory. Because he is also invoked against rats, he will perhaps aid us in the office, too. Until later, Gary, your militant working boy. Dr. Taub led a Benson and Hedges, looking out of the window of his office in the Social Studies building. Across the dark campus he saw some lights from the night classes in other buildings. All night he had been ransacking his desk for his notes on the British monarch of legend, notes hurriedly copied from a 100-page survey of British history that he had once read in paperback. The lecture was to be given tomorrow, and it was now almost 8:30. As a lecturer, Dr. Talc was renowned for the facile and sarcastic wit and easily digested generalizations that made him popular among the girl students and helped to conceal his lack of knowledge about almost everything in general, and British history in particular. But even Talc realized that his reputation for sophistication and glibness would not save him in the face of his being unable to remember absolutely anything about Lear and Arthur, aside from the fact that the former had some children. He put his cigarette in the ashtray and began on the bottom drawer again. In the rear of the drawer, there was a stack of old papers that he had not examined very thoroughly during his first search through the desk. Placing the papers in his lap, he thumbed through them one by one and found that they were, as he had imagined, principally unreturned essays that had accumulated over a period of more than 5 years. As he turned over one essay, his eye fell upon a rough, yellowed sheet of Big Chief tablet paper on which was printed with a red crayon, "Your total ignorance of that which you profess to teach merits the death penalty. I doubt whether you would know that St. Cassian of Imola was stabbed to death by his students with their styli. His death, a martyr's honorable one, made him a patron saint of teachers. Pray it to him, you deluded fool, you anyone for tennis, golf-playing, cocktail-quaffing pseudo-pedant, for you do indeed need a heavenly patron. Although your days are numbered, you will not die as a martyr, for you further no holy cause, but as a total ass which you really are. Zorro. A sword was drawn on the last line of the page.
Oh, I wonder whatever happened to him, Taup said aloud.
Chapter 6 Mattie's Ramble Inn was on a corner in the Carrollton section of the city, where, after having run parallel for 6 or 7 miles, St. Charles Avenue and the Mississippi River meet, and the avenue ends. Here an angle is formed, the avenue and its streetcar tracks on one side, the river and levee and railroad tracks on the other. Within this angle there is a separate little neighborhood. In the air there is always the heavy, cloying odor of the alcohol distillery on the river, an odor that becomes suffocating on hot summer afternoons when the breeze blows in from the river. The neighborhood grew haphazardly a century or so ago, and today it looks hardly urban at all. As the city's streets cross St. Charles Avenue and enter this neighborhood, they gradually change from asphalt to gravel. It is an old rural town that has even a few barns, an alienated and microcosmic village within a large city. Mattie's Ramble Inn looked like all the buildings on its block. It was low, unpainted, imperfectly vertical. Mattie's rambled slightly to the right, tilting toward the railroad tracks and the river. Its facade was almost invulnerable, covered as it was with 10 advertising posters for a variety of beers and cigarettes and soft drinks. Even the screen on the door advertised a brand of bread. Mattie's was a combination bar and grocery, the grocery aspect limited to a sparse selection of goods, soft drinks, bread, and canned foods for the most part. Beside the bar, there was an ice chest that cooled a few pounds of pickled meat and sausage. And there was no Mattie. Mr. Watson, the quiet, tan, café au lait owner, had sole authority over the restricted merchandise.
"The problem come from not having no vocation skill,"
Jones was saying to Mr. Watson. Jones was perched on a wooden stool, his legs bent under him like ice tongs ready to pick up the stool and boldly carry it away before Mr. Watson's old eyes.
"If I had me some training, I wouldn't be mopping no old hole flow."
"Be good," Mr. Watson answered vaguely. "Be well behaved with the lady."
"What? Ooh-wee! You don't understand at all, man. I got a job working with a bird. How you like working with a bird?"
Jones aimed some smoke over the bar.
"I mean, I'm glad that girl getting a chance. She been working for that Lee mother a long time. She need a break. But I bet that bird be making more money than me. Whoa!"
"Be nice, Jones."
"Whoa! Hey, you really been brainwashed," Jones said. "You ain't got nobody to come in and mop your floor. How come? Tell me that."
"Don't get yourself in no trouble."
"Hey! You sound just like the Lee mother. Too bad you two ain't met. She love you. She say, 'Hey, boy, you the kind of fool old-timey nigger I've been looking for all my life.' She say, 'Hey, you so sweet. How about waxing my floor and painting my wall? You so darling. How's about scrubbing my toilet and polishing my shoe?' And you be saying, 'Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I'm well behaved.' And you be busting your ass falling off a chandelier you been dusting, and some other whole friend of her coming in so they can compare their price. At least start throwing some nickel at your feet and saying, 'Hey, boy, that's sure a lousy show you putting on. Hand us back them nickel before we call the police.' Ooh-wee!"
"Didn't that lady say she'd call the police if you give her trouble?"
"She got me there. Hey, I think the Lee got some connection with the police. She all the time telling me about her friend on the force. She say she got such a high-class place the police never stick a foot in her door."
Jones formed a thundercloud over the little bar.
"She operating something with that orphan crap, though. As soon as somebody like Lee say charity, you know there's something crooked in the air. And I know there's something wrong, 'cause all of a sudden the head orphan stopped showing up 'cause I'm asking plenty questions. Shit. I'd like to find out what's going on. I'm tired of being caught in a trap, paying me $20 a week, working with a bird as big as an eagle. I want to get someplace, man. Whoa! I want me an air conditioner, some color TV, sit around drinking something better than beer.
You want another beer?
Jones looked at the old man through his sunglasses and said,
You trying to sell me another beer? A poor colored boy busting his ass for $20 a week? I think it's about time you give me a free beer with all the money you make selling pickle meat and soft drink to poor colored peoples. You send your boy to college with the money you've been making in here.
He's a schoolteacher now,
Mr. Watson said proudly, opening a beer.
Ain't that fine? Whew! I never go to school more than 2 years of my life. My mama out washing other people's clothing. Ain't nobody talking about school. I spent all my time rolling tire around the street. I'm rolling, mama washing, nobody learning nothing. Shit. Who looking for a tire roller to give them a job? I end up gainfully employed working with the bird, got a boss probably selling Spanish fly to orphan. Ooh-wee!
Well, if conditions really bad.
Really bad? Hey, I'm working in modern slavery. If I quit, I get reported for being vagrant. If I stay, I gainfully employ on a salary ain't even starting to be a minimum wage.
I tell you what you can do,
Mr. Watson said confidentially, leaning over the bar and handing Jones the beer. The other man at the bar bent toward them to listen. He had been silently following their conversation for several minutes.
You try you a little sabotage. That's the only way you fight that kind of trap. Why you mean sabotage?
You know, man,
Mr. Watson whispered.
Like the maid ain't being paid enough to throw too much pepper in the soup by accident. Like the parking lot attendant taking too much crap skid on some oil and crash a car into the fence.
Whoa!
Jones said.
Like the boy working in the supermarket suddenly get slippery fingers and drop a dozen eggs on the floor 'cause he ain't been paid overtime. Hey! Now you got it.
We really planning big sabotage,
the other man at the bar said, breaking his silence.
We're having a big demonstration where I work.
Yeah?
Jones asked.
Where?
At Leva Pant. We got this big old white man coming in the factory telling us he'd like to drop an atom bomb on top the company.
You sound like you pips having more than sabotage,
Jones said.
You sound like you having a war.
Be nice, be respectful,
Mr. Watson told the stranger. The man chuckled until his eyes filled with tears, and he said,
This man say he praying for the mulattas and the rats all over the world.
Rats? Whoa! Your people's got a 100% freak on your hand.
He very smart,
the man said defensively.
He very religious, too. He built him a big cross right in the office.
Whoa!
He say, You people's all be happier in the Middle Age. You people's got to get you a cannon and some arrows, drop a nuclear bomb on top this place.
The man laughed again.
We ain't got nothing better to do in that factory. He always interesting to listen to when he flapping his big mustache. He gonna lead us in a big demonstration. He say make all the other demonstration look like a ladies' social.
Yeah, and it sound like he gonna lead you people's right into jail,
Jones said, covering the bar with some more smoke.
He sound like a crazy white mother.
He kinda strange,
the man admitted.
But he work right in that office, and the manager in there, Mr. Gonzalez, he think this guy pretty sharp. You let him do whatever he want. He even let him come back in the factory any time this guy want to. Plenty of people's ready to go demonstrate with him. He tell us he got permission from Mr. Lever himself to have a demonstration. Tell us Mr. Lever want us to demonstrate and get rid of Gonzalez. Who know? Maybe they raise our wage. That Mr. Gonzalez afraid of him already.
Tell me, man, what this white savior cat look like?
Jones asked with interest.
He big and fat, got him a hunting cap he wearing all the time.
Jones' eyes widened behind his glasses.
This hunting cap green? He got him a green cap?
Yeah. How you know that?
Whoa!
Jones said.
You pips in plenty trouble. A police already looking for that freak. He come in tonight a joy one night, start telling this Darlene gal about a bus.
Well, what do you know?
The man said.
He tell us about a bus, too. Tell us he go riding into the heart of darkness on a bus one time.
He the same one. Stay away from that freak. He wanted by police. You poor color people, so I'll get your ass thrown in jail. Whoa!
Well, I gotta ask him about that, the man said. I sure don't want to get led on no demonstration by a convict.
Mr. Gonzalez was at Levy Pants early, as usual. He symbolically lit his little heater and a filtered cigarette with the same match, lighting two torches that signaled the start of another working day. Then he applied his mind to his early morning meditations. Mr. Riley had added a new touch to the office the day before, streamers of mauve, gray, and tan crepe paper looped from light bulb to light bulb across the ceiling. The cross and signs and streamers in the office reminded the office manager of Christmas decorations and made him feel slightly sentimental. Looking happily into Mr. Riley's area, he noticed that the bean vines were growing so healthily that they had even begun to twine downward through the handles of the file drawers. Mr. Gonzalez wondered how the file clerk managed to do his filing without disturbing the tender shoots. Pondering this clerical riddle, he was surprised to see Mr. Riley himself burst like a torpedo through the door.
"Good morning, sir,"
Ignatius said brusquely, his scarf shawl flying horizontally in his wake like the flag of some mobilized Scottish clan. A cheap movie camera was slung over his shoulder, and under his arm he had a bundle which appeared to be a rolled-up bedsheet.
"Well, you certainly are early today, Mr. Riley."
"What do you mean? I always arrive at this time."
"Oh, of course,"
Mr. Gonzalez said meekly.
"Do you believe that I am here early for some purpose?"
"No, I..."
"Speak up, sir. Why are you so strangely suspicious? Your eyes are literally flickering with paranoia."
"What, Mr. Riley?"
"You heard what I said,"
Ignatius answered, and lumbered through the door to the factory. Mr. Gonzalez tried to compose himself again, but was disturbed by what sounded like a cheer from the factory. Perhaps, he thought, one of the workers had become a father or won something in a raffle. So long as the factory workers let him alone, he was willing to extend the same courtesy to them. To him, they were simply part of the physical plant of Levy Pants not connected with the brain center. They were not his to worry about. They were under the drunken control of Mr. Palermo. When he did find the proper courage, the office manager intended to approach Mr. Riley in a most politic manner about the amount of time he was spending in the factory. However, Mr. Riley had lately become somewhat distant and unapproachable, and Mr. Gonzalez dreaded the thought of a battle with him. His feet grew numb when he thought of one of those bear's paws landing squarely on the top of his head, driving him perhaps like a stake through the unpredictable flooring of the office. Four of the male factory workers were embracing Ignatius around the Smithfield hams that were his thighs, and, with considerable effort, were lifting him onto one of the cutting tables. Above the shoulders of his carriers, Ignatius barked directions as if he were supervising the loading of the rarest and most precious of cargoes.
"Up and to the right, there!"
he shouted down.
"Up, up! Be careful! Slowly! Is your grip tight?"
"Yea?"
one of the lifters answered.
"It feels rather loose. Please, I am deteriorating into a state of total anxiety."
The workers watched with interest as the lifters tottered back and forth under their burden.
"Now backward," Ignatius called nervously. "Backward until the table is directly beneath me."
"Don't you worry, Mr. R,"
a lifter panted.
"We aiming you right at that table."
"Apparently you are not,"
Ignatius replied, his body slamming into a post.
"Oh my God! My shoulder is dislocated!"
A cry arose from the other workers.
"Hey, watch out with Mr. R!"
someone screamed.
"You man gonna bust his head wide open!"
"Please!"
Ignatius cried.
"Someone help! In another moment I shall probably be a broken heap!"
"Look, Mr. R,"
a lifter said breathlessly.
"The table right behind us now."
"I shall probably be dumped into one of the furnaces before this misadventure terminates. I suspect that it would have been much wiser to address the group from floor level."
Put your fists down, Mr. R. The table right under you.
Slowly,
Ignatius said, extending his big toe downward with great caution.
Well, so it is. All right. When I have steadied myself, you may release your hold upon my body.
Ignatius was at last vertically atop the long table, holding the bundled bedsheet over his pelvis to hide from the audience the fact that during the process of being lifted, he had become somewhat stimulated.
"Friends!"
Ignatius said grandly, and lifted the arm that was not holding the sheet.
"At last the day is ours. I hope that you have all remembered to bring your engines of war."
From the group around the cutting table there issued neither confirmation nor denial.
"I mean the sticks and chains and clubs and so forth."
Giggling in chorus, the workers waved some fence posts, broomsticks, bicycle chains, and bricks.
"My God! You have really assembled a rather formidable and diffuse armory. The violence of our attack may surpass my expectations. However, the more definitive the blow, the more definitive the results. My cursory inspection of your arms, therefore, confirms my faith in the ultimate success of our crusade today. In our wake, we must leave a sacked and pillaged liver pants. We must fight fire with fire."
"What he say?"
one worker asked another.
"We shall storm the office very shortly, thereby surprising the foe when his senses are still subject to the psychic mists of early morning."
"Hey, Mr. R., pardon me,"
a man called out from the crowd.
"Somebody tell me you in trouble with the police. Is that right?"
A wave of anxiety and uneasiness broke over the workers.
"What?"
Ignatius screamed.
"Where did you hear such slander? That is totally false. Some white supremacist, some upstate redneck, perhaps even Gonzalez himself, no doubt, began that vile rumor. How dare you, sir? All of you must realize that our cause has many enemies."
While the workers were applauding him soundly, Ignatius wondered how that worker had learned of the mongoloid Mancuso's attempted arrest. Perhaps he'd been standing in the crowd before the department store. That patrolman was the fly in everyone's ointment. However, the moment seemed to have been saved.
"Now this we will carry with us in the vanguard,"
Ignatius shouted over the last sprinkled applause. He dramatically whipped from his pelvis the sheet, flapping it open. Among the yellow stains, the word "Forward" was printed in high block letters in red crayon. Below this, "Crusade for Moorish Dignity" was written in an intricate blue script.
"I wonder who been slipping on that old thing,"
the intense woman with the spiritual bent, who was to be the leader of the choir, said.
"Lord!"
Several other prospective rioters expressed the same curiosity in more explicitly physical terminology.
"Quiet now,"
Ignatius said, stomping one foot thunderously on the table.
"Please! Two of the more statuesque women here will carry this banner between them as we march into the office."
"I ain't putting my hand on that,"
one woman answered.
"Quiet, everyone,"
Ignatius said furiously.
"I am beginning to suspect that you people are not actually deserving of this cause. Apparently you are not prepared to make any of the ultimate sacrifices."
"How come we gotta take that old sheet with us?"
someone asked.
"I thought this supposed to be a demonstration dealing with wages."
"Sheet? What sheet?"
Ignatius replied.
"I am holding before you the proudest of banners, an identification of our purpose, a visualization of all that we seek."
The workers studied the stains more intensely.
"If you wish to simply rush into the office like cattle, you will have participated in nothing more than a riot. This banner alone gives form and credence to the agitation. There is a certain geometry involved in these things, a certain ritual which must be observed. Here, you two ladies standing there, take this between you and wave it thus with honor and pride, hands held high, etc."
The two women whom Ignatius indicated ambled slowly to the cutting table, gingerly took the banner with their thumbs and index fingers, and held it between them as if it were a leper's shroud.
"That looks even more impressive than I had imagined," Ignatius said.
"Don't wave that thing around me, gal,"
someone said to the women, creating another ripple of giggles from the crowd. Ignatius flipped his camera into action and aimed it at the banner and the workers.
"Will all of you please wave your sticks and stones again?"
The workers complied merrily. Myrna would choke on her espresso when she saw this.
"A bit more violently now. Brandish these weapons fiercely. Make faces. Scream! Perhaps some of you could jump up and down if you don't mind."
They laughingly followed his directions. Everyone, that is, but the two women who were sullenly holding the banner. In the office, Mr. Gonzalez was watching Miss Trixie bump into the door frame as she made her entrance for the day. At the same time, he was wondering what the new and violent outburst from the factory meant. Ignatius filmed the scene before him for a minute or two more, then he followed a post upward to the ceiling for what he imagined would be an interesting and rather recherché bit of cinematography suggesting aspiration. Envy would gnaw at Myrna's musky vitals. At the top of the post, the camera focused upon several square feet of the rusted interior of the factory's roof. Then Ignatius handed the camera down to a worker and asked to be photographed. While the worker aimed the lens at him, Ignatius scowled and shook a fist, entertaining the workers greatly.
"All right now,"
he said benevolently when he had taken the camera back and flipped it off.
"Let us control our riotous impulses for the moment and plan our stratagems. First, the two ladies here will precede us with the banner. Directly behind the banner comes the choir with some appropriate folk or religious melody. The lady in charge of the choir may choose the tune. Knowing nothing of your musical folkways, I shall leave the selection to you, although I wish that there had been time enough to teach all of you the beauties of some madrigal. I will only suggest that you choose a somewhat forceful melody. The remainder of you will compose the warrior's battalion. I shall follow the entire ensemble with my camera in order to record this memorable occasion. At some future date, all of us may realize some additional revenues from the rental of this film to student organizations and other similarly appalling societies. Please remember this. Our first approach will be a peaceful and rational one. As we enter the office, the two ladies will carry the banner to the office manager. The choir will then form about the cross. The battalion will remain in the background until needed. Because we are dealing with Gonzalez himself, I suspect that the battalion will be called upon in short order. If Gonzalez fails to respond to the emotion of this spectacle, I shall call, attack! That will be the signal for your onslaught. Are there any questions?"
Someone said,
"These are a lot of shit."
But Ignatius ignored the voice. There was a happy hush in the factory, most of the workers eager for the change of pace. Mr. Palermo, the foreman, appeared drunkenly between two of the furnaces for a moment, and then disappeared.
"Apparently the battle plan is clear," Ignatius said when no questions were forthcoming. "Will the two ladies with the banner please take their positions over there by the door? Now the choir please form behind him, and then the battalion."
The workers formed rapidly, smiling and sticking one another with their engines of war.
"Fine! The choir may now begin singing."
The lady with the spiritual bent blew a pitch pipe, and the choir members began singing lustily,
"Oh, Jesus, walk by my side. Then I always, always be satisfied." "That really sounds rather stirring," Ignatius observed.
Then he shouted,
"Forward!"
The formation obeyed so rapidly that before Ignatius could call anything else, the banner had already passed through the factory and was rising up the stairs to the office.
"Halt!"
Ignatius screamed.
"Someone come help me off this table!"
"Oh, Jesus, you be my friend, right, oh yeah, right up till the end. You take my hand and I feel grand, knowing you walking, hearing me talking. I ain't complaining, though maybe it's raining when I'm with Jesus."
"Stop!"
Ignatius called frantically, watching the last of the battalion file through the door.
"Come back in here immediately!"
The door swung closed. He got down on his hands and knees and crawled to the edge of the table. Then he swung around and, after a long while spent in maneuvering his extremities, managed to sit on the edge of the table. Noticing that his feet were swinging only a few inches from the floor, he decided to risk the jump. As he pushed himself free of the table and landed on the floor, the camera slid from his shoulder and hit the cement with a hollow, cracking sound. Disemboweled, its film entrails spilled onto the floor. Ignatius picked